Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're going to be talking again about the terror year of 1937 in the Soviet Union. We're coming to the end of Everyday Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick. And there's still such a lot of interesting stuff to say. The thing that she's really drawn out in the bit that I'm going to talk to you about is the relationship between the Stalinist state, the Soviet press, and the terror itself, and how the Soviet press was put to use in shaping a particular sort of narrative about the, you know, those who were considered to be guilty parties, the usual suspects, and the sorts of individuals who were being denounced. There's a kind of an irony at play in some of the newspaper reports. The newspaper reports reported on these dreadful things that were being uncovered, like corruption and cronyism, and the fact that some party members or many party members would have regional networks of blat, of which is, you know, a term for you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And this was the kind of thing that Soviet citizens knew all about. None of these things were secrets. It was long understood that most of the party was corrupt in this way. Whether the people who were being put on trial were actually guilty of these things is another question. But certainly, this kind of crime is widespread. The things that Pravda accused party members of were the sorts of things that, if they had been said by ordinary members of the public a year or two beforehand, would have been seen as anti-Soviet or hostile. So by 1937, you have an organ of the state, the Soviet newspaper Pravda, articulating these things that had previously been seen as anti-Soviet, and that shows you that there's this kind of Stalin's cultural revolution and his war against the Soviet bureaucracy and the party bureaucracy itself, which was how we can kind of understand the terror, had begun to do that which previously had been unthinkable. So Sheila Fitzpatrick writes of several examples where public anger was motivated or mobilised against party figures. She writes, a Kazan newspaper, for example, chose luxurious lifestyles as a ground of attack. In writing of the recently disgraced leader of the city Soviet, including P.V. Aksensov, the former Soviet chairman and husband of the later Gulag memoirist Eugenia Ginsburg, who faced criminal charges for the misuse of government funds. It was alleged that they built themselves an elite dacha settlement, taking funds from local building trusts, as well as soliciting contributions from factory directors, who would be among the users of the dashes, out of their directors' funds. The Dolce Vita at these dashes was described as below. Life at the dasha was lavishly appointed. Breakfast, dinners, suppers, snacks and drinks, bed linen, everything came for free. Hospitable hosts, generous at the expense of the state, did not have to bother with any financial calculations. Here, in the shadow of the pines and the fir trees, no one worried about accounts and accountability. They spent money as they wished, without the usual formalities. Altogether, about 225,000 rubles of state funds were wasted on exploitation of the dashes. And obviously using the term exploitation in there, which is used as I put it in big speech marks, was a definite kind of code to the reader who would be versed in this kind of Marxist-Leninist discourse.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In a time of shortage, in a time of widespread hunger, and of housing shortages, these sorts of stories were perhaps designed less to make people terrified of internal sabotage and furiously angry about the fact that they were being taken for fools by these corrupt party figures. A similar description of luxurious living accompanied Pravda's attack on the director of a Komsomol publishing house, Edie Lenschister, who was described as a bourgeois degenerate, who unceremoniously ripped off the state by furnishing his apartment in expensive Karelian birch and providing himself with a luxurious apartment in the publishing house's dasha. These stories and the behaviours that were described in them were characteristic, as many of the readers knew, of the whole cohort of communist cadres, even though they were being attributed only to a certain scapegoated group of enemies of the people. So that the public were largely kind of not fooled by this and saw this kind of behaviour as fairly typical of what party members got up to. The whatever idealism that existed during the 1930s, and there was some, as we've looked at when we looked at this book in the past, plenty of Soviet citizens who believed that a new country, a new world really was possible as a result of the revolution. But for the vast majority of the population, a kind of a weary cynicism had set in long, long before 1937. Outside of Russia's political elites were the Soviet cultural elites, who may well have been party members, but in many ways were a kind of a class set apart from the political class that was increasingly the victim or the target of Stalinist terror. The intelligentsia, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, included communists, many of whom held important institutional positions, and some of whom had been oppositionists. There were personal and family ties between the political and cultural elites. Galina Serebryovska, for example, was the wife of one defendant in the Piatkov trial, and the former wife of another. The communist journalist Leopold Averbach was the leader of the Association of Proletarian Writers, RAP, as he was known, until its dissolution in the by the Central Committee in 1932. He was a friend of the brother-in-law is a friend and brother-in-law of Genrikh Yagoda, the chief perpetrator of the terror before he's got rid of by Yezhov. Head of the NKVD. The poetess Vera Inber was the daughter of a cousin of Trotsky's, and so on. So there is and there had been since Maxim Gorky, you know, a very, very close relationship between party and intelligentsia. At certain points, the intelligentsia were the victim of the party, and it would turn that in the by 1937. The members of the intelligentsia that understood Stalin's wishes and whims and were on the right side of Stalinism would be some of the chief proponents of the terror, and some of the kind of the intellectual voices of the terror. A web of client-patron connections linked politicians and leading members of the creative intelligentsia, writers, artists, theatre people, scholars and scientists. As for engineers, they often worked so closely with communist bosses in industry that they were liable to share their boss's fate if the latter were disgraced. Finally, the intelligentsia had the elite status and privileges comparable with those of the communist managerial class. If there was to be terror against the elites, denunciation of privilege, the intelligentsia was unlikely to escape unscathed. The first, Sheila Fitzpatrick calls it, the first plague bearers in the intelligentsia were communists with an oppositionist past or oppositionist connections. These were the sorts of people whom it was terrifying to know. These were the sorts of people whom, if you had a friendship with them or you were related to them, then this was a very frightening time, and the chances are there would be almost nothing you could say to the NKVD when they came to arrest you. There were those who would seek to denounce members of the intelligentsia or people who had been associated with oppositionism as quickly as possible, to denounce them before they indeed could be associated with them. And this created an incentive for Soviet citizens to look at members of their family, even who were politically suspect, and to find things to accuse them of that would then please potential interrogators in the future, and to present yourself as a kind of a loyal member of society. Richard Bickel, a drama critic, a member of the Union of Writers, who had once headed Zinoviev's secretariat at the Comintern and had been active in the left opposition, was a defendant in the Kamenev-Zinoviev trial in August 1936. Within a week of that trial, the Central Committee cultural officials had sent party leaders a memo about oppositionists and other possible enemies in the Union of Writers. As the memo made clear, arrests among the writers had already started. Serebrikova and several former members of the RAP leadership were among those named under arrest. And there was a reason for serious concern about others, Vera Inber, for example, for her family connection to Trotsky. Ivan Katyev, because he had given money and friendship to various disgraced Trotskyites. Ivan Gonsky, editor of the journal Novye Mir, because he had published Pikel's work, and so on. In self-criticism in the Writers' Union, other names had surfaced, including those of well-known writers who were not members of the Communist Party. The poet Boris Pasternak was in trouble for not signing a collective request from well-known writers for the execution of Kamenev and Zinoviev. The prose writer Yuri Alesha was in trouble for defending Pasternak and for having been a drinking companion of one of the show trial defendants. So the entire sort of cultural establishment, you're looking at kind of literary giants like Pasternak, were under the threat of constant suspicion. And this was, you know, obviously a great way of ensuring their total compliance. But it also led to the kind of a great cultural chilling effect throughout this kind of this grouping of people thought of as the Soviet intelligentsia. And there were, of course, those who many of the most famous writers in rap became proponents of Stalin, and if not active arguers for the terror, then.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Apologists for Stalin's mass arrests and the sorts of people who would not just make a good case for terror to Soviet citizens, but these arguments are exported and heard in communist parties across Europe, and also Europe's and America's fellow traveller movement, the left liberal intelligentsia, who looked upon the Soviet Union either as a necessary force of modernization, however brutal, or part of the being actually kind of a utopia. It's worth observing about the fellow traveler movement, as David Cote often points out, and in his book, or did point out in his book, The Fellow Travelers, that they believed that this was a good thing for Russia, that Russia was being transformed by Stalin. But very few of the fellow traveller movement ever wanted anything remotely Stalinist to actually happen in their home countries. Which betrays a kind of an oddly colonial attitude in many ways. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, in the early months of 1937, Leopold Averbach emerged as the centre of vilification in the literary community. Averbach became totally demonised, a satanic figure like Judas Trotsky himself, polluting everything and everyone he'd ever come into contact with. Although he was called a Trotskyite, Averbach had not really been an oppositionist in the 1920s. Although he had admired Trotsky, his real sin was the close connection with Yagoda, together with the fact that as a former leader of rap, the main instrument of persecution of writers during the Cultural Revolution, he had made many enemies who welcomed the opportunity to settle scores. One of Averbach's fellow leaders of rap, the playwright Vladimir Kershon, who was also a member of Yagoda's social circle, was excoriated with almost equal vigour as Averbach. One of his attackers was his former wife, who complained that he had physically and morally abused her. So revolutionary terrors present opportunities for sometimes the pettiest of kind of settling scores. And in the case of Averbakh, that's clearly what's happened. Here is somebody who had been a bully to his fellow writers during Stalin's Cultural Revolution of several years earlier. There was now an opportunity to remove him. And terrors also give opportunities to ruthless careerists when there is the need to have somebody removed. A violent bloody terror is quite handy in that regard. Contacts with Bukharin, personal and institutional, as well as professional, damage many reputations in the literary and scholarly worlds. As one commentator in Literary Weekly put it, it was necessary to burn out Bukharin's influence. Bukharin was not yet under arrest, but he was already disgraced and isolated, and at the February-March plenum, he had been subjected to a devastating cross-examination by Stalin, Molotov and others, and the plenum had expelled him from the party. Young communist intellectuals who had been his disciples, "Your little school," as Molotov contemptuously put it, had already been arrested and testified against him. In May, Bukharin was expelled from the membership of the Academy of Sciences. Nikolai Gorbunov, the Bolshevik chemist who was permanent secretary of the Academy and thus had the distasteful task of acting as prosecutor in Bukharin's expulsion, did not survive him long. So the culture of denunciation as well was very effectively used by the NKVD, particularly if you look at the case of Bukharin, who was utterly friendless by 1937, long before he's put on trial himself eventually convicted and executed. Bukharin has become the victim of this sort of social purge, where those who once looked upon him as a mentor and looked upon him as perhaps the future of the Soviet Union on the right began to ostracize him under the threat of denunciation and arrest themselves. The beginning of the Great Purges in the Red Army came in June 1937, when a new and shocking plot was disclosed, that of Marshal Mikhail Tukhachevsky, General Yona Yakir, and other top military leaders. None of these men had belonged to the opposition in the 1920s. A closed court martial convicted them all of treason, specifically of organising a political military conspiracy with the support of Germany, and they were immediately executed. They had been caught red-handed as spies, Pravda said, in a rambling speech that closed discussion of party leaders. At the closed discussion of party leaders that followed the executions, Stalin noted that those hunting for enemies of the people would not necessarily find them amongst former oppositionists. That may or may not have comforted former oppositionists, but it surely intensified the fear by party leaders with irreproachable political pasts. A week after the execution of the military leaders, Pravda announced that it had received a letter from the former wife of Yakir, in which she denounces and curses her former husband as a traitor. This letter, presumably coerced, did not save Sara Yakir from punishment. She ended up in a gulag with a teenage son, encountering amongst other old acquaintances the young wife of Bukharin. The wives of big enemies of the people were routinely arrested along with or shortly after their husbands. Natalia Sats ended up in a room of wives in the Baturka prison, along with the wife of Marshal Tukhachevsky. There were even special camps in the gulag for wives of traitors to the motherland. So here we have something again that is really a hugely distinguishing feature of the Soviet terror, the way in which once again newspapers denounce not just the notables, these significant figures of party and army, but also their family members, and the way in which wives and children are arrested. And the reason for arresting them is the assumption that if you share the private life of this individual, you must have known that they were a traitor. And if you knew they were a traitor, and you can't not have known, and you didn't denounce them, you must be one too. This is the logic or the illogic of it, and so the question is therefore, what is the individual hiding behind the facade that they put on to the world? How have they been corrupted by this dangerous enemy of the people? Of course, this is all complete nonsense and fantasy and paranoia, but the fact that it's nonsense and fantasy and paranoia still tells us the fact that these are ideas that are kind of operative, that make things happen, tell us an awful lot about the functioning of the terror and its purpose and its kind of deeper kind of ideological roots. Okay, so we're gonna finish there. I guess the only thought to mention is that there had been a kind of an institutionalized fear or suspicion or a belief in the danger of enemies within since 1917. And in fact, the entire regime was built on this whole concept that there was always someone to blame, and there was always somebody looking to subvert what the Soviet Union was trying to do. There are enemies without, but even worse, enemies within. And how the regime basically functioned is operative logic. Okay, well, thanks very much, everybody. If you can, check us out. I'll be posting this podcast down on the website, explaininghistory.org. There's some new content going up there fairly soon. Do remember, if you can support the podcast on Patreon, that would be great. And thanks very much for listening, and I'll catch you next time. All the best. Bye-bye.
Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.